previously on the Supporting Act podcast.
Now, tell me now, are you now or have you ever been a communist?
I just want to tell the truth.
You're weird.
Well then fuck all of you!
I'm gonna cry.
Let's get down and dirty.
And me with my dick out.
Oh my god, it's my daughter!
I'll set you on fire, Rob Schneider.
I would love to act in a musical.
Hey, this is life, whatever. La-di-da-di.
I don't know, it's not working because I tried to download the download to my downloads and then I downloaded the download.
This is crazy, man. I can't believe it.
I saw things out of a Pasolini movie in real life, you know? It was like Sallow in a hotel room in Las Vegas.
The key to writing is to not do the first thing that pops into your head.
You should avoid watching people through windows.
I love the spiked bleach blonde hair. I wish I had spiked bleach blonde hair.
Everything makes me anxious.
I'm gonna shine a light on all this bullshit.
Yeah, I bet there's no dead bodies or drugs in here.
Why am I happy you're crying?
Do I look like I have a plan to you? I'm in a bathrobe and Crocs.
What the hell am I gonna do with the rest of my career? Nothing.
Well, I guess this is just my life. I guess I'm just gonna keep on being awesome.
I'm a vulnerable person.
This is 2 hours of dudes with no shirts on, pestering people.
This week on a very special Supporting Act podcast.
We should adopt a child. He can live right here.
You're listening to episode number 27 of the Supporting Act podcast, in which I interview professional wrestler, comedian, and host of the Art of Wrestling podcast, Colt Cabana. We get into mixing humor and athletics, being an independent artist, and how watching a 9-year-old girl fight a 30-year-old man from Manitoba could change the way you view professional wrestling. Stay tuned. You might learn something. All right, so welcome to episode number 27 of the Supporting Act podcast. My name is Matt Moskal. I'll be your host. I'm a musician by trade, a journalist by education, and I've been in the danger zone, east of the Pacific Ocean, west of London, England, south of Mars, and north of hell, oh yeah! If you are not familiar with the show, this is the program where we shine a light on performers just shy of the mainstream spotlight to discuss their art, music, comedy. Every week we bring you this independently produced podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Liberated Syndication, ShowbizMonkeys.com, and we've also got a Tumblr, you know, for the kids. My guest this week has a very unique niche in the world of independent professional wrestling that he has carved through an entertaining comedic style and through his own weekly podcast, The Art of Wrestling. It's the one and only Colt Cabana. But before we get to my conversation with Colt, I'm going to push a button here and we're going to play the music for upcoming events. Alright, so on Friday, June the 6th, I am performing as part of the first ever Winnipeg Spoken Word Festival's Spoken Weird and Haiku Deathmatch Showcase at the Gas Station Theater in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Doors are at 7 p.m., show starts at 8, $12 general admission, $10 for students. I will be participating in this year's Haiku Deathmatch, where I hope to become the grand champion again. Alright, so on June the 7th, at the Gimli Motorsport Park, I will be performing in the afternoon as part of the Real Love Summer Festival. Full weekend passes to that are $20, Friday or Saturday passes are $15, Sunday day pass is $5. Camping is free, just email reallovewinnipeg@gmail.com to let them know you're coming. But basically, I will be doing a songwriting workshop with Kieran West, as well as Richard Inman and Joe Madden. And I'm really stoked on this one. So check that out. That's Saturday, the 7th of June at the Gimli Motorsport Park. So before we get on with the show, I believe a huge thank you is in order for everyone who filled out the West End Cultural Center on Friday night. The first ever spoken word was an unbelievable success. The event went off without a hitch. There was not an empty seat in the house from what I could see. And the response afterwards has been extremely positive. I mean, you guys were a perfect audience. In my episode with comedian John Wing, I talked a little bit about how poetry crowds are a little bit different than any other crowd. And turning nearly 200 people from concert goers to a poetry audience felt like it could have been a bit of hypnotism at first. But, you know, it takes a special kind of group of people to be so open-minded and participate in the fashion that they did. So just a huge thank you to everyone who came out and made that a memorable night. I want to say I'm really sorry that I was so drunk at the end of everything, but that sneaky bastard Mike Ehrenberg managed to bring me a bottle of scotch backstage, and I think it was revenge for making fun of his toe, because he gave me a generous, like, free rein through a bottle of scotch, and I thought, oh yeah, that's fine, I'll just indulge in a little bit of this. And by the end of the night, I was ranty. I think I asked my girlfriend about 90 times on the walk home. Do you think we won tonight? Do you think this was a victory? Do you think that, like, this was a win for the poets? This was a win for the losers in life? Do you think this is what that was? Is that how this feels? Are we celebrating our ephemeral a moment of pride and victory? And she just kind of looked at me the whole time and went, "Yeah, Matt, we won. We're good." So thank you to everyone who came out and actively just made this feel like one of the best nights I have ever had in my life. Thank you, Winnipeg.
I'm leaving with the WWE Championship on July 17th, and who knows, maybe I'll go defend it in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Maybe I'll go back to Ring of Honor. Hey, Colt Cabana, how you doing?
Hey, guys, the Art of Wrestling podcast. I'm your host, my name, Colt Cabana, live in the studio, apartment.
June 7th, Colt Cabana, you are headed back to Raw.
Hey, June?
No, June.
Oh, okay, sorry, start over.
June 7th, Rawway, New Jersey.
It sounded like we could.
Jersey, I said. Juicy? You think I said New Juicy? June 7th, Colt.
I don't, heard that.
Time. No, I didn't know.
Hey, it's Scotty Goldman making my WWE debut right here on Friday Night SmackDown. And right now, I'm in a box. I'm trapped in a box. Hey, there I am! Wait, two Scotty Goldmans in two different places at the same time?
My guest this week on the show is Colt Cabana. He is a 15-year veteran of the professional wrestling industry, competing in Chikara, Ring of Honor, Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, and pretty much every independent wrestling promotion under the sun. Despite a short run in WWE as Scotty Goldman in the late 2000s, Cabana has made his name as sort of an everyman within the industry. In 2010, he created a podcast called The Art of Wrestling, which has featured interviews with everyone from legends like Bruno Sammartino, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and Jake the Snake Roberts, to independents like Sharkboy, Reckless Youth, and Kenny Omega. It's a really interesting study in what it takes to be a professional wrestler, but also I like the way that he kind of takes people from every aspect of the industry, whether it be legends to people grinding it out every day on the road, as independents, and the connecting factor between all of them is they're professional wrestlers, and he brings that up in the interview, of course. Those are his words, not mine, actually. On June 27th, 2011, there was a very important kayfabe-breaking promo in professional wrestling performed by CM Punk, who was then in pursuit of the WWE title. As his contract was coming to an end, he sat on the entrance ramp, and he basically broke the fourth wall, tearing into politics and ideas in wrestling that hadn't ever really been touched on national television on that scale. And midway through the promo, he actually waved to the camera and referenced Colt. And as you can probably guess, there was a spike in searches for Cabana. Now, if you haven't heard this podcast before, I have alluded to my relationship with professional wrestling in the past. I refereed a couple of matches just to see what it's like to be on the other side of it. I've referenced it in numerous interviews, different aspects of the politics of wrestling. And around the time of this famous pipe bomb promo, as they called it, I began to develop an interest in Colt Cabana as well. I jumped on the bandwagon and downloaded as many episodes of the Art of Wrestling podcast as I could. This was also around the time I was getting into shows like WTF with Marc Maron and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. So Colt Cabana kind of became synonymous with the podcasting culture for me as well. And it was interesting because I could hear a comedian talk to a other comedian on the circuit about what it's like to go through the day-to-day sort of grind of trying to entertain as many people as possible and then travel to the next town and do so there as well. And then would hear a wrestler talk about it, and there are so many striking similarities that I couldn't help but do this interview when the opportunity arose. Because I saw Colt Cabana was coming into town a couple of weeks ago and decided that I was going to take a chance and try and email one of the podcasters that got me into podcasting in the first place. And Colt was amazingly generous about it, said to meet him at his hotel. His only condition was that I bring him a Tim Hortons breakfast sandwich, which I did, because I live a couple blocks away from one, and, you know, if it meant an interview, I mean, why not? And what resulted is, you know, there are moments in this conversation. What I was aiming for was a conversation about professional wrestling and about being an independent performer and sort of the ties that bind all different forms of art when it's not on the mainstream level together. Did I accomplish that? Yes and no. There's a couple parts in here that are a little bit inside-y for some people's liking. And there's plenty of parts where we're being as vague as humanly possible. He kind of dances around talking about things like, CM Punk leaving the wrestling industry or his relationship with Jim Cornette. But I also like that it's vague because I think that also makes it a little bit more relatable for some people in that regard. And we disagreed about a few things, which is not something that's ever really happened on the show before. There are a couple of parts in there where, he's trying to take a playful jab at me and I'm trying to take a playful jab at him and we're just not meshing properly, you know? We're not jiving on the same rhythm and I kinda like that actually. I kinda like that I got to sit across from somebody whose show and whose work I've respected for years. And we kind of got to have this moment where I realized that we're very different people with a lot of similar interests. And, you know, take it as it is. And I got to learn a lot about what it's like to be someone like Colt Cabana. Let's go now to my interview, with the one and only Colt Cabana, wrestler, comedian, and podcaster.
Everything I need in this life.
You have made yourself extremely comfortable, and that's always a good place to start off with the podcast.
When I set up to do my podcasts, I put a piece of gum in, which I didn't do here, and I get a chair and I raise my feet. I think it's important to be comfortable.
Yeah, that's true. I like podcasting when I'm like laying like belly down in my bed, like legs kicking back like a schoolgirl. That's a little too telling, but anyways.
Is that for real? I do that.
Yeah, I do it all the time.
Okay.
I'll post like, a girlfriend of mine posted a photo of me pacing back and forth in my house with my laptop in my hand editing sound for one episode, so.
Well, that doesn't say that you were on the podcast doing that.
No, well, it was clearly.
That's editing. Podcasting and editing are two different techniques.
Oh, absolutely. Do you edit your own show?
I do.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How do you enjoy the sound of your own voice for like a couple of hours every week?
Oh, well, I don't listen. So when I do like the conversations, I don't really edit those necessarily. Oh,
okay.
But I'll do the intros and the outros. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't want to listen to my show, but I don't mind listening to myself as I edit.
Fair enough. I'm just noticing a lot of things about myself listening back to this show where I'm getting to a point where I'm trying to change the way I speak.
Like, yeah.
Like, I mean, for example, I say absolutely. You're now going to notice it 100 times throughout this entire conversation, but I say absolutely more than most people use the like commas, for example.
Well, those are words like when you're not sure what to go to or what to do. It's like crutch words. There
crutch
you
words,
go.
Yeah.
In Japanese it would be clutch, but in America it's crutch. Crutch words.
Awesome. One thing I really wanted to talk about right at the top here is you're from Deerfield, Illinois. The more I'm interviewing Americans for this show, I'm just trying to like get a point of view from where they come from. And I come from a town of 12,000 people, and you are so far the first guest on the show to come from a town with within a range of 1,000 people of the same town I came from.
Honestly, I have no clue how many people are in Deerfield. I have no clue how many people are in Chicago or in Manitoba. Like, the idea of people doesn't grasp to me.
No.
So we come from a similar sized town?
Yes, we come from a similar sized town and within the periphery of a larger city. Like, I'm from around London, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if you're familiar with London, Ontario, but basically it was okay for a while pretending to be British. You know, people thinking I was from exotic London, England.
Yeah, I'm from London.
Yeah.
Really? But wait. Yeah, London. That's all you gotta need to know.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, yeah.
International man of mystery.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. But it, like growing up in the periphery of a larger city, being half an hour away, I mean, you kind of, to me, does it feel like you really want to try and do whatever you can to stand out? That when people don't expect much based on where you come from, like,
well, people did because Deerfield, and I don't know how similar it is, but Deerfield is a nicer place in the Chicago suburbs, where a lot of the families and a lot of the fathers were real estate agents and lawyers and doctors. So there was not the famous people in our town were the couple handful of athletes that came from where we were from. There's a guy named Ryan Hogan who went on to win a ring for the University of Kentucky, the basketball team, and actually one of my best friends went on to play with the Colts and the Indianapolis Colts. I have to make everything American here, and to just to really make sure in the NFL, that's your version of the CFL. He yeah. won a Super Bowl ring, but there was never like really anybody famous. From the arts that much, if at all.
Yeah.
So the pressure was a lot on people from my town to become rich, successful businessmen and wear a lot of suits. And I never felt that pressure because I never wanted that life because I knew in school I was never as smart as half, if not most, of the people. Just the way it was, you know. I was a B-minus student at best. And I probably cheated to get to that. So I was probably a C-minus student for real, you know?
Yeah.
But the school itself, I don't know, there's 400 people in my graduating class, maybe 1,500 people in our school. In our high school, seemed normal to me. I don't know any different. I remember a couple schools away, there was like triple that. And I was just like, how do you know everybody? But I, you know, talking on my podcast and talking all in the locker room and all over the world with people, there was people that went to school with 12 people. So, you know, to them, me going to that side school is amazing, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting when you go on like a Wikipedia page for like Deerfield or the town I'm from called Ingersoll. They don't really point out under notable people too many like business people or too many or CEOs or anything like that. It's usually like, who are the musicians that mm-hmm. came from here? Who are the athletes that came from here?
I always find it funny too, because I wonder how like pissed off they are.
Yeah.
Because, you know, maybe I'm a struggling artist, but like I get to be noticed as like a guy from Deerfield, but and these guys have like billion-dollar houses, and I assume their way of thinking is like, notice me, I'm successful. You know, it has to be.
Yeah,
it has to be. And I'm sure they're like emailing Wikipedia, being like, come on, man, look, I just bought my fourth house in Florida. You know, put me in. But
yeah.
Well, right. It's a trade-off, I guess.
You just go in and edit the article and just be like, you know, but then there's no articles written about them. There's no paper trail of their right. success other than maybe they're like posting on the business they work at's website. I always say a sign that you've succeeded in life is that your website looks better than the website of the place you came from.
What's the place you came from? Like Deerfield.org?
Yeah, like, I mean, I came from, like, Ingersoll, Ontario, which is this tiny... Like,
they have a website?
Yeah, they have a website, and it's just... It's
well, when I grew up, places didn't have websites, like...
Right.
So, I mean, they're starting from just as much scratch as I was.
Yeah.
But I've never even thought of that, nor will I continue to think that. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm just saying, your site, in comparison to, like, you know, it's much more aesthetically pleasing than if you were to look up Deerfield. You'd probably get bored with the site in a few minutes, but you've got, like, you know...
Well, I think everyone got bored with the town within a few minutes. So, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Wait, is that what you say?
Not in that tone.
Oh.
No, but I could. I could start adopting a
should know, adopt character. A child. We should adopt a child. He can live right here.
I think, yeah, this hotel room is sufficiently sized.
He can live in that little chair.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously then, coming from sort of a culture of doctors, lawyers, et cetera, I mean, you've talked about this a bit on your show, but basically the choice to become a wrestler, I find it extremely fascinating because I see a lot of guys like yourself and like Zack Ryder, for example, as well, people who really were kind of wrestling nerds first. If you don't mind using the term,
huge,
of course.
Yeah, of course, please. Yeah.
Like a huge wrestling nerd, you did all your research, you knew facts and figures probably I wouldn't even be able to memorize. And then sort of when you went into it, like Zach, for example, bought all of his like ring gear when he was still in training, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I wasn't that, like it's, even though I was a huge nerd, like I still had respect for wrestling. Like I knew like I couldn't just get my boots, like I had to get trained and I had to learn the job before I was able to get gear or boots. But, you know, he came from a culture, he's a couple years younger than me, so like, and like not, like, I'm 34, maybe he's 29 or something like that. And not that, but that 5 years makes a huge difference, especially with the internet, because I mean, the internet, like, if it came, like, prevalent, like, in 96, like, to really, like, to learn information about wrestling, you know, he was, like, 10 or 11, and I was, you know, 16, 17, almost getting into wrestling. So I understood that, you know, there was, like, I'm big about the respect of wrestling.
Yeah.
And the culture in that respect. But, you know, nowadays, it's just, like, I don't know nowadays, but it's a little different even with 5 years. And, but yeah, obviously I was a huge wrestling nerd. I was obsessed with it as a child. It took over my life. And like, sometimes you see people who know facts about stuff and can rattle stuff off and you're like, how do they know this stuff? Like, I would never know this stuff, but the reality is I kind of do when it comes to professional wrestling.
Yeah.
And so that's my thing. And then for other stuff, that's their thing.
Yeah. But to have that basis and that background, you have a love for it, which I think is amazing, especially considering, all right, well, I'm a bit of a comedy nerd. Like, mm-hmm.
As am I.
I've become sort of a student of stand-up comedy myself lately. I'm even reading, Shane Moss recommended that I read a book called The Humor Code, which, beautifully opens with a quote, dissecting humor is like dissecting a frog. Nobody wants to look at it, and when it's all said and done, the frog is dead.
Do you want to know how much of a comedy nerd I am?
Oh, go ahead.
I saw Shane Moss in Edinburgh last year, like at a bar, and I was too scared to go say hi to him.
He was a smart guy.
Literally right next to me. It was like him, my friend, and me, and like I didn't have the balls to be like, oh, hey, I'm a big fan. Like I couldn't even do that because I was performing there. So I get it, and good on you.
He's probably really high at the time.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, that guy, immediately the first thing we talked about was psychedelic drugs.
Wow.
Yeah, and you're a pretty clean guy yourself.
I don't do any drugs.
No.
Yeah. No. That's good. Was that your way of like asking, like, does he not?
Oh, no.
You're pretty clean.
Well, I mean, you don't even drink coffee.
No, yeah. But that's not because of drug reason or stimulants.
Yeah.
That's because I don't like coffee. And I don't like beer. I don't like the taste of beer. Like, no. I wouldn't be totally against it, but it just doesn't taste good to me.
Well, you don't seem to have been defeated by life completely. I feel like coffee and beer are sort of these substances that I associate with, like, you know, like Ernest Hemingway types or people who have sort of been, like, you know, not just rolling with the punches, but, like, completely destroyed at times.
I thought you were going to say Ernest from Ernest Goes to Camp.
I was just listening to that. How did this get
made?
Yeah,
so did I. That's what was on my head.
Yeah, exactly.
No, not destroyed by life at all.
No.
Gratefully. And they say, you know, wrestlers, they take the plunge. It's a hard life. You got to jump into it.
Yeah.
I just recently rewatched that thing CNN did, I think, when Benoit killed himself and his family. And they were just, like, hoping for everyone to talk about it. And they had to have Punk on because he was the only one. But he was the only one that didn't do drugs. And, like, that was the only guy. And that was the reason he probably got a big push in the first place is because he was the only person on the roster who didn't do drugs of any sort.
Yeah.
But I'm the same way. I feel that, I mean, I've been in this life and this lifestyle for 15 years. I've been on the road. I've been in WWE. I've traveled. I've done tours for 3 months where you're wrestling every single day. And I, you know, I've never once was I like, I need pills. I need drugs. I need alcohol.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of like, that's my stance on it. And that's my stance on life. Like, I don't think you need these substances to get yourself through. Now, whether he does it just because it's, or he or whoever else does it just because it's fucking awesome, then I don't, you know, I don't blame them for that. Like, if you want to just do shit
because
it sounds amazing and it makes you feel fun and takes you out of the reality for a second, sure.
I mean, he's just, and I respect Shane a lot, but he's one of those people that talking to him reminded me of these people I went to university with, the kind of people they don't drink. They do try like cocaine or like hallucinogens just to see what the feeling is like and just to see what ways they can, like, they're doing sociological or psychological experiments on their brain, basically. Like, they'll do ayahuasca just so they can feel the presence of some higher power.
And I was just in South America.
Yeah.
And like one of my friends, I won't say his name because he's pretty famous. It'll out him, but he's like, you gotta go do ayahuasca. Is that the one from South America, right?
I think so, yeah. I don't know enough about it. I wouldn't even know how to get it. So.
Yeah. I feel, and maybe I've been, maybe the DARE program or whatever it is as a child is too much into me, but like I feel the second I do cocaine or the second I do probably even marijuana or whatever it might be, I'll just become addicted and I'll do it for the rest of my life. So like, it's just easier not to do it. I'm okay not doing it. Like, I can't not eat pizza.
Right.
It's the best. So I know probably that's what would happen if I started doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, pizza kind of gets away from you, huh? There's just days where you're like, you're counting down the minutes before it's okay or you feel comfortable enough ordering another pizza.
Yeah. Yeah, it's awful. It's an addiction. Yeah. Just eating shit. So like, but like, that's the only one. I don't know. And Diet Coke, I'm big in. So like, I have my addictions. You know, I'd say glad enough that they're the ones that are good for you, but in the long run, this Diet Coke addiction will probably kill me before it kills somebody with cocaine that does like a shitload of cocaine, you know?
Yeah.
Sadly, but that's the reality of it.
Yeah. I was going to say about this comedy nerd sort of obsession that I've had. I always like insight on this subject. I'm out at like every open mic stand-up comedy night I can get to. And some of them are better than others given the fact that it's all about who's organizing it. Like, do you believe that there are two types of people that make it in the business? Like, I do, that there's people who are really talented or there are people who are really good at promoting themselves.
Well, when you start, I mean, I guess like, yeah, they call themselves comedians, but I mean, I don't know the way to get into comedy. Like, you know, Marty DeRosa is obviously a great friend of mine and one of my comedy partners. And, he's just like, I went into a shitload of open mics and like, that's how I became a comedian. So like, I don't know if that's how you become a comedian. I always think it's weird that for wrestling, you have to go, you have to pay money, you have to learn a trade. It's like a trade school.
Yeah.
And then, I know comedy classes are kind of frowned upon, stand-up comedy classes, where they're just like, go to open mics and learn the job. And it's like, what's wrong with having a mentor, somebody guiding you or giving you the tricks? But I think I find it interesting that it's kind of frowned upon.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, what is the point where you go to a open mic and then you have a 5-minute set? Like, what's the point? Where's the point of where you could call yourself a wrestler and you can't call yourself
exactly
a wrestler?
That's kind of the question I guess I was stabbing at. There's, when did you know that you were a wrestler?
I think maybe after my first match, but I didn't go around. I never went around saying I was a pro wrestler. And it's funny because when I was, I went to college 4 years, graduated with a degree. 3 of those years I was a part-time professional wrestler, I guess, wrestling every single weekend on the weekends, 2-3 shows a week.
Yeah.
And then 2 years after that, I was a teaching assistant. And then finally after 5 years, I was able to go pro full-time.
Yeah.
And at one point I was making more wrestling than I was teaching. And I still never knew when people say, what do you do for a living? It was always like a hard answer to answer. And so like I always loved the idea of when I was able to stop teaching, I could say I am a professional wrestler. That is my job. But those middle years were weird because I never like, I kind of say, well, I kind of have two jobs. And sometimes I'd say I'm a teaching assistant, but I also wrestle. So in terms of like my full-time job or that I am a professional wrestler, I really didn't start saying it until I was done teaching and doing it full time. But I mean, after my first match, I guess I would consider myself a professional wrestler. I trained, I learned the job.
Yeah.
They stuck me in there. And although I didn't do, I honestly didn't do too bad. Pretty good actually. But, you know, yeah, that was my first day of being a pro wrestler, I guess.
Because, I mean, if you're like a janitor and they hire you and you go in at night and you clean the place up.
That first night?
Yeah, you don't leave the first night going, like, I don't know if I'd call myself a janitor so much as I just clean this place once.
Someone's, hey, janitor, clean this up. Oh, okay, that's me. I'm the janitor.
Hey, wrestler, give him another scoop slam.
Yeah. But that janitor doesn't know his job.
That's true.
So he can call himself a janitor. But, you know, there's janitors that work 20 years and, like, me and you probably might laugh at it. Maybe that's a joking point where, you know, like we use janitor, but there's people who do 20 years and know the job and know the insides outs and know the tricks of the trade.
Yeah.
And, they probably take a lot of pride in it. I hope they take a lot of pride in it. Yeah. And so, they're definitely more, they know more about janitorial duties than that guy doing it one night.
They have, like, the skeleton keys. I would never belittle somebody that knows how to get into every room of a building.
Do they still have, has technology, you know, risen up at all? Or do we still have 90,000 keys?
I want to say key cards? That there's still 90,000 keys.
At what year do you say it turns into something different?
I don't know, because I still think having the actual key is a little bit more beneficial, just based on the fact that, just look at computers, for example.
If they break down or something?
Yeah, exactly. If they break down, if somebody figures out how to, like, make the magnetized strip. Like, I have a friend, the first time I ever went to his house, within 5 minutes of meeting him, he programmed his laptop to have an Xbox controller play N64 games on it. My brain can't even comprehend that, so, I mean, people can hack vending machines. I'm pretty sure you can find a way to fake it with key cards.
Yeah, then there's gotta be something else. There's gonna be a point.
Yeah.
Where it's not a ring of 80,000 keys. And I'd like to put some money on that.
Yeah.
I don't know. 50 years, 60 years?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Maybe when we're fossils in the ground. Yep. And,
yeah. Or maybe in 5 years, you know, Shark Tank style. They'll just come up with something good.
Yeah. So I really like the sense of humor you have with your style of wrestling. Sort of for example, I was watching a clip from National Pro Wrestling Day, if I'm not mistaken, 2013, the Mike Quackenbush match. And you did the sort of the Gorgeous George gently taking off the jacket and folding it up and then, yeah. You know, perfectly. Like, that is, I remember a book when I was a kid hearing that was...
Well, you gotta finish the joke.
Oh, yes. And then you just toss it
over
the top.
And I just hucked it away, right?
Yeah. I remember as a kid hearing that was like Gorgeous George. That's sort of how the heel was really, born. Like, the theatrics of the heel were really born. His wife made him this really nice robe. And I like that you're an expert on professional wrestling. Like, if you weren't a wrestler, you could certainly be in any other facet of the business. Just
like
because.
A podcaster?
Exactly. Okay. Wow, that's a novel concept.
Thank you.
The comedy in wrestling comes from a place of love. You're not mocking it. You're not belittling it. When did you know that comedy was going to be part of wrestling for you? And then when did you know that wrestling was going to become part of comedy for you?
Not very early on. I'd say 5 or 6 years, and I told this story on Marin's podcast. Was
that bastard?
Yeah,
he got to it
before you did.
That's fine.
Was I did this thing in the ring with AJ Styles, and I tripped him, and it got a laugh, but it got the biggest reaction on the show, and probably the biggest reaction that I've ever had to date.
Yeah,
and it was a comedy spot, and like it was my natural reaction because I was like, what if we're doing this? We're doing this, and then like. Put out my foot, you trip. And he's like, all right. And I was just like, that's what I thought was funny and would be funny. And the crowd thought it was funny and everybody laughed and got the biggest reaction I probably had to date. And I was like, I think I'm on to something. Not I'm on to something, but like I have to go with my natural instincts and I have to go with the way I really feel. And so from there, I mean, that was 2003, and I'd started in 1999. So, and I was wrestling like every single weekend, you know. I'd put in a lot of matches at that time, probably over 300 matches or whatever it might be. And I started putting that into my shtick. And I realized that nobody else was doing it. And I think the key to anything is how are you different? How can you be different? Why do you stand out? Why does somebody go home and say, I remember that guy and not that guy? Well, they wouldn't say, I don't remember that guy. They just say, I remember that guy. And so, yeah. And then when I got fired from WWE. I came home to Chicago and I was like, I'd like to start kind of getting into comedy a little bit. I moved back to Chicago from Florida. I was like, I live in the home of comedy, yeah. With Second City and IO and just so much rich history. And I started doing some training and some shows at Comedy Sports. And I noticed a couple things. I noticed A, that I wasn't as good at comedy just by itself. But when you put wrestling into the mix, like I was great.
Right.
And like I got it and I was comfortable and I understood. And so I realized like I needed wrestling to be the focus of my comedy to kind of be successful. And it was a successful platform or idea. So from there, the $5 wrestling and especially the Colt Cabana and Friends show or the one I did in Edinburgh.
Right.
Like those were super successful because I wasn't on stage trying to think of situations or think of voices or characters outside of the world of wrestling, stuff that I'm probably not comfortable with.
Right.
But in my world, in my world of wrestling, I'm very comfortable. And that's when you get good at comedy, I think, is when you're just comfortable on stage, you're comfortable with who you are, where you are, the situation. And I'm very comfortable with pro wrestling.
Yeah.
It's funny because most of the antics that I do now would be considered a heel or bad guy. But in 2014, it's kind of like the Stone Cold Steve Austin theory,
yeah.
Where he was, if you took that character and put it in the 1940s or 1950s, he'd be the even in the 70s maybe he'd be the biggest bad guy in the world, and in the late 90s he was the biggest babyface good guy sensation ever. Bigger than Hogan, had bigger t-shirt numbers and merchandise sales than Hogan, and ratings, I guess, to a point. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I just made that up. but, so, yes, I mean, some of the antics that I do are meant for a bad guy, but get a great reaction. And, the folding of the jacket, that's from Cat Weasel. That's stolen right from him. He's a 1970s British wrestler who wrestled only in England. Sadly passed away in a car accident.
Oh.
He's one of the most, one of my most favorite comedy wrestlers ever. And, I'll take little things here and there, but it's important to make everything your own. So, through 15 years of kind of dissecting and figuring stuff out, I've come up with, essentially I have jokes that I have. Much like a comedian, I have jokes that I tell physically and I use in the ring. And I've worked out what works. I've worked out what doesn't work. And that's kind of how, what I use.
Yeah.
It's like I have sets and the littler shows, I'll try out stuff. And I'll see if the jokes hit. And I'll see if there's something there. And I'll go, I know there's something there. I'm not sure how to do it. And I guess I'm not saying because I'm not a stand-up necessarily, but what's fun is that like there's a style, so there's a specific move or maybe there's a move that I find funny and I can get into it like 95,000 different ways. So I can constantly take my moves and change around my jokes, whereas a comedian maybe sticks to one specific joke if it's a two-liner or whatever. And I understand, I don't want to speak for a stand-up, but I can... In my head, it's like you hit the joke.
Yeah.
But there's so many different things I could do with a physical joke in wrestling, which I do.
it's like Brian Posehn talks about metal and does like parody metal. And basically the quote he says is that it comes from a place of love first, so he can make fun of it because he can point out what's funny about it because he cares so much about it.
Right.
And there's a whole proud tradition of humor in wrestling. There's a whole proud tradition of slapstick. There's a whole proud tradition of going back to... Hell, if you watch like Singing in the Rain, there's a whole slapstick routine there that's a lot of tumbles and a lot of falls and what some might consider a bunch of bumps, basically.
Yeah, well also, so I do this thing called $5 Wrestling.
Yeah.
And some people might take offense to it and be like, how can you do that? Actually, there is a specific man who is very against it, who lives in Louisville, Kentucky. And he's just like, he said, how are people supposed to take wrestling serious? How am I supposed to do my job? How am I supposed to make money if these guys are doing this to professional wrestling?
Yeah.
And my comeback is so easy. It's Weird Al Yankovic and Star and Spaceballs.
Yes.
And I've said this a couple of times, but it's just so Weird Al does a song called Eat It. Does that mean Michael Jackson stops making money?
Right.
And Eat It was very, very successful and made a lot of money. Spaceballs, poked fun at Star Wars. Does that mean people then won't go and be in love and follow Star Wars the crazy worshipy way that they do? Of course they will. It's parody. It's using humor. It's parody.
Yeah.
And that's on every aspect of everything. I mean, parody has been, especially with my people, the Jewish people, it's been around forever. I mean, that's just a thing. And, I don't think it hurts wrestling at all. And I'm very proud of it. But my specific wrestling style doesn't make fun of wrestling at all. It makes fun with wrestling. And that's very important for people to know is, everything I do is justified. It's justified comedy. So, in the sense of when I'm wrestling, like I always, whatever comedy stuff I do, I always want to win. That should always be obvious that I'm doing this because it will help me win. I'm making you laugh because it will take you off your game and it will get you frustrated or flustered, and that will essentially allow me to win. And that's what wrestling is all about. I mean, it is winning and losing.
There's even a sect of the internet, a lot of people who just take things way too seriously. Again, back to the internet, but I'm going to specifically talk about Reddit, for example.
Okay.
Where, after WrestleMania 30, there were a ton of people just going, oh, we're in a new golden age of wrestling. Everything is going to be amazing from here. And then as soon as you get, like, not to knock anybody, but as soon as you get, like, a great Kali match or something, they're immediately like, oh, man, why are they still booking this kind of thing? And they flip out because something they don't like is on TV. Well, I mean, it's because they're so personally and emotionally invested in these contests. And it's like they take it so seriously. And if they don't see the humor in it, or if they don't see the parts of it that are supposed to be fun, they're just going to end up freaking out every time the person that they're cheering for loses. And they're just going to end up freaking out whenever things don't go their way.
Yeah, but they seem to have stuck with it.
Yeah.
Forever.
That's true.
And, you know, that's always a thing that I always see is people are like, well, that's it. I'm gone. And then yeah. The next week they're back there complaining. And they're complaining for 20 years straight. And WWE has 20 years worth of their money or whatever it might be, or you're a wrestling fan. So I never, Triple H is always like wrestling, internet wrestling fans or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But there, that's always going to be the internet when there's a forum. And I feel that, sadly, the negative person is more likely to jot down their thoughts on a message board, on a subreddit, on a tweet, or whatever it might be, than the positive person sharing their light. So it's always going to be that when there is that kind of forum for people to just complain and bitch. But at the end of the day, those WWE guys, they're doing it right. I mean, 70,000 people came to that live show, and how many ever ordered it on pay-per-view and have the network or whatever. And even if the numbers aren't as good as they wanted it to be, there's still over half a million people who have that network and who watch it and, who pay money and support those guys, their bills. So the internet fan, for whatever it might be, will always just be the internet fan.
That is completely true. And the negative voices are always louder than the positive ones. That's not just a sports or a sports entertainment thing. That is every walk of life. That is, not just comment boxes, but I mean, if you just sit in the coffee shop for a few hours, I know you don't drink coffee, but if you just sit in the coffee shop for a few hours, you're going to hear somebody talk politics and talk negative about politics and point out all the things that are being done wrong. And then just like there are fantasy bookers in professional wrestling, there are, you know, fantasy politicians. You know, if I were mayor and if I ran things around here, I'd do it a little bit differently, you know?
Yeah, I wanted to start a blog, and I still might. Just like, I don't know what it was called, but it'd just be like awesome stuff of wrestling. Where like every week I would just be like, here, this is something that's great, or this is something that you should buy or purchase or support or follow or something. Because I do like the idea of positivity. And because sometimes negativity gets stuck in my head, and sometimes I see people complaining about me or whatever it might be, my first gut reaction is to be like, fuck you, this, that. But then like my second gut reaction after I don't follow the first gut reaction is to be, I have to put more positivity in this world about wrestling and about something that I like, and hopefully people will follow and see that instead of telling the world or people surrounding you about something that you hate, just don't talk about it and tell somebody about something that you like.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, too, is I just watched that Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville match, the dark match from the UK, where it wasn't even, like, mic'd properly. All you can hear is the ring. You can barely hear the crowd and everything. And it's kind of nice just to hear a match where there's clearly a reaction and everything, but just to hear a match where it just feels like there's no one's telling you how to feel about it. You can just take it in, and you can see that these are just two great workers and just two people putting on a good show, and it's a pretty squeaky clean match. Like, it was very high intensity and very fun to watch, and it was only on one camera angle, but it was just a bare bones simple performance that is phenomenal, and I think people should seek it out because it's at such a like room temperature sort of setting. Nothing about it is telling you to feel a certain way about it. You know, you start to pick up on the positives more than the negatives.
Oh, see, I would say you could also. People might be like, it's not as cool because it wasn't as dressed up as they're used to matches being dressed up, if that makes sense.
No, that is true.
With this guy, you know, the explosions and this and that and the crowd and the mic'd crowd and you could hear people cheer. Sometimes that sways people whether they do like a match more or not. And especially, and it makes a big difference because a match in front of 15,000 people with the place going crazy is sometimes going to be received as a better match than a match in front of 50 people. With the place going crazy, just because the acoustics and the sound, and that adds to a match. And so that's hard because, and I'm not taking your opposite point, because it is nice, but
it's become a debate.
Yes, but sometimes that adds to a match is all that, the aura around it, everything surrounding it. And nowadays in wrestling, like, people have come used to, the quick camera switches, Michael Cole always talking, like, yeah. You know, JBL, whatever, sometimes the pushed in audio on the audience.
Yeah.
And that sometimes can make for a great match.
That is
sitting at home.
100% true.
But on the opposite end, sorry, there's nothing like live performance. It's the best. So those people that were there saw the same thing, I guess, kind of what we saw sitting on YouTube watching Sammy and Neville. And sometimes those live performances, and you go back and you watch them on TV or pay-per-view or whatever it might be, they're not as good. But in person, I think it's the best way to watch wrestling. And I know I was following the PWG results last night, and PWG is a wrestling promotion in Reseda, California, in front of 400 people every 6 weeks or so. And it's like the greatest experience ever. It's the crowd is so awesome. It's an intimate thing. And like that audience and that at that time makes all those matches great. And whether you go home on DVD and sometimes they don't play as well, but in the moment, it's just amazing to be there.
The idea for me with a match being as masterfully done, but without any of the things they're telling you to cheer for it, I think that if you can still pick up on all the positives in it, I think it can completely change the way you watch these things. And then you can go back and re-examine the way you watch something that you had a very positive emotion towards, maybe because there was a loud crowd reaction. And I think that's sort of the best way to watch wrestling for me is, or any art form for that matter, is to sit down and watch it and think, if I couldn't hear this crowd, if no one was telling me to like this, would I still like this, basically? But enough about the big leagues. This is not a show about your time in WWE or about the WWE. This is a podcast about the independents, and this is about people who are not always, you know, this is a show about people who don't have a car and have to, you know, ask for guys to deliver them breakfast sandwiches in hotel rooms. And
you're my rider.
That's right. But no, there's something that I got from one of your Reddit AMAs that I really enjoyed, and that is the Colt Cabana match, the match right before intermission.
Yeah.
Where it's a prime opportunity to sell merchandise. And this is something that's very much like prevalent in punk rock, just getting off stage and then immediately going to your merch table like drenched in sweat and immediately selling merchandise. I mean, like, do you think working for a larger company, you'd still be as motivated knowing that you're not getting the one-on-one experience with the fans and you're not getting to sort of put your brand out there personally?
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. When I was there, it was just nice that I could just sit back and collect a check.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to worry. But, like, a lot of it, I was just like, man, I could be when I was in like their developmental system, I was just like, man, I could be ordering shirts and why can't, you know, like I was complaining, like, why can't we sell shirts to these guys? Like, I wanted to use the same DIY techniques that I was using before I got there while I was there. And they were just like, why would you want to? And it was like, because I need money. And when I first signed there, I wasn't paid that much. I wasn't paid much throughout my time. And that's, somebody believes that you make a lot of money with WWE. But, we didn't make a lot of money. And so I was trying to make more money.
Right.
And I don't know, some people were trying to make more money by going up to the main roster and being in WrestleMania. I was just trying to make more money so I could, afford protein for that week. And so when I got back to what I was doing, like, yeah, a lot of that drives me is because you never know where your paycheck is coming from. You never know how you're going to make money. And it drives me to make the money or make the paycheck or be involved. Like, I can't sit at home. Like, I have to be involved if I want to be able to live. And yeah, the Colt Cabana match, it doesn't ring true so much anymore because luckily, I'm in a better place, I guess just on the map where a lot of people don't know me necessarily. So if I go to the merchandise table, like, my fans will come, whether they've seen me wrestle that night or not, they want to come and buy a shirt or whatever, a picture, and they want to support. Or before, the way I would get them to become a fan is they would watch my match, and I was very, I was very confident that my style of wrestling and just my wrestling in general is I would be able to make them a fan. And so the Colt Cabana match was make them a fan before intermission, and then because by the main event, the show's too long.
Right.
It's a four-hour show, a three-hour show. They're tired. So an intermission is like the intermission. Before intermission is basically the independent main event. That's what I've concluded.
Yeah.
It's an hour into the show, an hour and a half. They've been prepped a little bit by the bands beforehand or whatever. And then that last match is ready to go. And the intermission is kind of when you get to breathe. So, you get them, you make them your fan, and then you go right, they know you, they saw you. Hey, that was that guy in that ring. I really enjoyed him. I remember him. I'm going to go buy his picture.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how that whole theory worked out. I don't think I'm the first one to do it.
Right.
But I got to a point where I could say to the promoters, this is what I'd like to be on. And they'd say, okay. And it got to the point where, like, they kept on saying okay, and people kept on knowing me to say this is what I'd like to go on, I think Chris Hero deemed it the Colt Cabana match, because when I wasn't on the show, he'd say, I'd like the Colt Cabana spot.
Yeah.
And so the people with the merchandise and who kind of got that and understood that, that's the match they would seek out.
Yeah, well, there's guys like himself or yourself or El Generico as well, where you have a very distinctive brand that you bring with you everywhere too. And it's this very, like, you get to see that brand develop over time. If you're coming out to matches, you become an instrumental part in constructing that brand versus being in a crowd of 10,000 people. If you're in a crowd of 500, you're one person. That $20 or whatever you're spending to help that brand grow, you're helping that brand become a thing. And it's like you go to a concert and you're already a fan of the headliner. And so to help something grow, such as your brand or a brand like that, it makes a fan feel more like they're part of the process, and it makes a fan feel more like they are pro wrestling mm-hmm. versus just being a fan of pro wrestling.
That's why I have fans, I feel, is I've forever been on the ground floor. Like, even now, if you become a fan of mine, you're still on the ground floor.
Yeah.
And it's like, people still feel they could say, I was a fan of him when.
Yeah.
And, yeah, 15 years later, like, I still haven't hit, I guess. But I have so many people who are like, look, I've known him when.
Yeah.
I'm on the ground floor. And, you know, I don't know if it's a moment of selling out or a moment of hitting it big or whatever. You know, who knows, like, what the people will feel of me. Although there is a lot, you know, there's always negativity and there's always people like, I don't get him and I don't whatever. Yeah. I feel like I have a lot of people who are still like, you gotta check this Colt guy out. He's, you know, he's underrated or whatever it might be. The same way you would say about a band coming up, even though I've been in it a long time. I still feel I have kind of some of that cred. Although it's dwindling. I see a lot of it dwindling, but it's still there. I'm still a guy who people say you should see him when.
Right. But it's still, I think you're getting to shake hands with gods and still remain a pretty powerful mortal in a way as well. Like with the podcast, for example, like.
It was basically my own wrestling promotion, essentially what it was, because no wrestling promotion really wanted me. And at that point, WWE had fired me. TNA had said, no, thank you. They
really?
They flew me in and they gave me this match and I did really well. It was against TJ Perkins and the fans were very receptive and Vince Russo said, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this guy, was his quote. So, and then at that point, ROH, the guy from Louisville, from the Southern guy, had started taking power, and I knew he didn't like me. So essentially, I wasn't gonna have a promotion.
Right.
And I needed a way to talk to the fans, and I needed a way to do it without somebody telling me how to do it. And podcasting was the way. And it's allowed me, to become, I don't know, sometimes you look at it, and whether you want to base it on Twitter followers, but you know, like, if I have more Twitter followers than the Ring of Honor, the promotion itself, it makes me smile. It's just like, I kind of see myself as another promotion in wrestling. And, it was the only way that I could get to the fans, get to the people who liked wrestling, uncensored, unfiltered. And shaking hands with gods, yeah, sure. I mean, a lot of my friends have become and were and are very, very successful in pro wrestling.
Yeah.
In terms of millions of dollars. They make millions of dollars. And these are my friends, my cohorts. And so, it's just, we're all on the, you know, take away the money, we're all just the same kids that had a passion and love wrestling.
Yeah.
So it's easy for them to come on my show and to talk and whatever it might be. And I guess that's how. And with the success and then and the numbers going up and people listening and people talking about it and just being in locker rooms with people, like, you know, but that's how, like, Stone Cold does come on my show or Bruno Sammartino or whatever, either people vouch for me or people know me or whatever it might be. And most of them are just my friends. They're just my friends from in wrestling.
And it's great when people take a chance on you as well, because I mean, that's one thing that's amazing about the podcast market as well, is that you have an opportunity to just reach out to somebody and say, I'm interested in having a conversation about this. I feel that, you know, there might be some insight in this talk. There might be something that someone can learn from our conversation. And, you know, I think that a lot of aspiring wrestlers will hear your conversation with Stone Cold Steve Austin, and then hear your conversation with, like, Ricochet, and hear your conversation with Reckless Youth and all these other people that, you know, are all over the map in the industry. And they'll take these conversations and they'll hear that there's so many common bonds between people at every different level that if they have the desire to do so, and if they think they have the personality that suits it, that maybe it's an opportunity. It's DIY. It's the classic DIY situation.
And I like that we're all, at the end of the day, there's a list of people on my show, 200 of them at this point. And they're all wrestlers, you know, for the most part. But it's just like, whether you're Ricochet or Steve Austin, they're both wrestlers. That's what they're labeled as. So they're even, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not putting anybody above anybody on this podcast list. It's just a list of all people in wrestling. And I really, really like that. I like that there were no, for, you know, Mick Foley's, there was no, fireworks and pyro for the show. It was like he got the same intro.
Yeah.
And he got the same talk that Tyson Dukes did, or Zach Gowen, or Jimmy Jacobs, or whatever, and I like that a lot.
And he's a very soft-spoken, very polite person from personal experience.
Mick, he's great, yeah. But at the end of the day, he's a millionaire, and Jimmy Jacobs, you know, sleeps on his friend's couch, you know, or like so. But also at the end of the day, like they're both, I classify them both as professional wrestlers.
Well, there's a thing in wrestling that I think is a little different from other art forms, personally, and that is, and this is why I have the utmost respect for wrestlers as well. Is you have guys like, for example, I think Chris Jericho said he had so many matches that he wanted to win before he started putting the little guy over, or whoever he was coming up over. I believe he said that in his book, if I'm not mistaken. Like, he made a list, and then he started making a point of, like, okay, now he's going to lose to Evan Bourne, now he's going to lose to Fandango at WrestleMania, even though apparently that's controversial. But the idea of, like, you can get to the top of the mountain, and then you can let yourself, you can ease off a bit in plateau, and let other people take that spot, and you're still respected in the business. You don't see, like, John Bon Jovi opening for, you know, an up-and-coming hair metal band or anything like that. He's still going to want that headlining spot. And there's still some of that in the industry. But
yeah, but he probably, I'm sure he takes people,
yeah,
not under his wing, but shows, you know, that it comes to a point where you help out the others.
Right, and he puts them on tour, he puts them on his record label, but it's a little different than having them headline a show that he's involved in, or have them come out as the victorious one on a show like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm well aware, like, and I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but, like, the point of the podcast was, like, yeah, to put a little spotlight on me, but it was also to spotlight my friends, and right away, I mean, that was the goal, and I think we were successful with, and by we, I mean me and my friends or whatever it might be, and the fans with Cliff Compton and Luke Gallows. And obviously, you know, I just came out with my movie, The Wrestling Road Diaries 2, which features them, but the point was, is like, I knew that I could have a platform to let these other guys shine. Right. And I don't know if that was my unselfish act, but like, I knew that there were so many of my friends and so many great people who hadn't had the opportunity to shine that the world should know about. And I feel after coming on my show, a lot of these people, they do better for themselves, or they make a better connection with fans, with wrestling fans. People get to know them better.
Right.
It's like a wrestling show that you do really well on, but it's a podcast that you came on and you really made new fans because people got to know the real you.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's my way of, stop winning my matches. And, I think we both win. You know, it's a double draw.
Exactly. You look strong and they look like the winner.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful booking right there. That's a good way of,
And there is like wrestling booking to the podcast, you know, like I look at it that way. Like,
yeah.
Like there's psychology in what I'm doing and why I'm doing it.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to talk about the concept of plateauing as well. Mm-hmm. You're saying that you're kind of feeling like you're...
And I did in 2010 when I started the podcast.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I'm fucked. So I hope this thing catches on, because I felt I got very, very stale, sadly.
Yeah. But do you feel like by having something that can be considered a cornerstone of part of the industry, a part of the independents especially, this is something that people look to? If you see a name on that podcast, I mean, it could be the same as opening for a certain comedian and therefore being considered legitimate, or it can add a legitimacy to a career, or it can just simply draw attention to a side of a personality of somebody that people already know.
Yeah, but so if Dave Attell is, you know, if someone is opening for Dave Attell,
yeah,
and they're like, this is great, huge for my career. At the same time, Dave Attell could be like, all I'm doing is these 500 seat theaters or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even like, I don't even know, like Aziz or whatever, but like, I saw a picture of him doing like a 3,000 seat arena, but like,
yeah,
at a point it could be like, ugh, I've done 3,000 seat arenas for the last 15 years. I'm bored. I'm stale. I'm stagnant. Like, it hasn't gone up. It hasn't gone down. So it's just the perception of that specific person. And it happened with my friend, you know, like, he's just, how many, you know, he made millions of dollars in WWE, and he was just like, I can't take it anymore. And he's
right.
Out, you know, he's out of here.
That's kind of what I was alluding to as well. And I have the utmost respect for that decision as well. And I'm not one of those detractors online that's like, oh, this person's doing anything that, you know, reflects poorly on them. The truth is that when you come from the independents and you're used to things being done a certain way, and you've always sort of had creative control over your career in some way or another, and you know, when you don't get, when things don't go your way, you have a right to speak out against it, or a right to act a certain way about it. Because the truth is at the end of the day, like, if you can't go out there and say that you're 100% happy with what you're doing in your job or in the ring or in your art form, then I mean, it's time to start looking at other options. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, but that, I don't know if that has to do with being stale.
It happens with being stale. I think that you need to be able to shake things up.
Well,
every
then,
now
right,
and then.
You need, yeah. Yeah. But so and I guess for me, like, if this was about me, and I was like, and I'm worried about getting stale, like, it's not on my own doing. I feel just like, oh, maybe I've been doing the same thing for 4 years now.
Right.
Like, how am I going to shake it up? But I guess, yeah, I have the ability to do whatever I want. I mean, not, you know, to make, it takes money to make money. So, like, and I've thought a lot about, like, I guess what I'd have to put money into doing something, or whether it be video, or I don't even know, you know,
right.
Like, but I know, like, maybe it's time to start. And I see all the wrestling podcasts come out now, and I say to myself, like, man, like, what's the next step? What's the next thing? What can I do that's 5 years before these guys, and they'll be doing this in 5 years, and then I'll be doing something else. That's what comes. But it's hard on an independent level. It's easy when there's a lot of money behind you.
Right.
And there's a lot of money in your pocket, a lot of money backing you, and you can go put in $18 million into a WWE network, you know? Like,
yeah.
Essentially, that's what WWE is like, we're stale, we gotta change it up. And they're like, how are we gonna change it up? Well, we're gonna make this WWE network. But we have $18 billion or whatever to put into it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
On an independent level, it's hard to recreate yourself knowing that you don't have, like, constant money coming in, because if it fails, it fails, and then you're completely done. So, and I forget the B, there isn't that much money, you know? Like, you're investing whether, you know, your career, like, that's why people who like go with a gimmick on the independent scene, or people who change their gimmick on an independent scene, is, I remember, I can't even remember his name before, but his name was Relic.
Okay, like Killer backwards, yeah.
Yeah, do you know, remember who that was? He was part of the FBI, Johnny something.
Oh, okay.
Johnny the Bull.
Mm-hmm.
And he changed to Relic. And then, like, it's like, well, nobody really knows who this Relic is, and like, now he's kind of not anyone, but like, he could have been Johnny the Bull for the next, you know, maybe 10, 15 years on the indies. It's like, imagine if Honky Tonk Man changed his gimmick to, like, Freddy the Guido, and, like, he was Freddy the Guido, and, like, it could be the most successful thing, like, now, you know? Like, but no, he's gonna go be Honky Tonk Man.
Yeah.
It's the easy thing.
But even then, you could still go from, like, Brody Lee to Luke Harper, and still kind of carry that same persona, certain aspects of that character. And
yeah, but he's allowed to do that because there's so much money behind him.
That's true.
It's just like a giant corporation said, you're going to be Luke Harper. And he's like, yep, fine.
All right, yeah, well,
I make a shitload of money now. And
I'm not going to wash this fucking shirt.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to complain if you want to change my name.
Yeah.
Because you're giving me all this money.
No.
And there's security because I know I have a contract.
Absolutely. Well, I think you're doing a lot of things. So, like, you have, like, $5 wrestling. You have, you know, you have Worst Promo Ever, which, you know, it's a fantastic YouTube channel, because you know, wrestling has given you a strong foundation in improv. And I don't think that's something that can be taught anywhere else, the way that, you know, you can kind of have to roll with the punches and make it look natural. I mean, there was a whole article on crack.com about, you know, this whole concept of nobody has a harder job than wrestlers, because they showed a clip of, like, Bret Hart injuring himself and still having to win a match. And you have to learn to improvise, and you have to learn to adapt. And that's something that I think has been instilled in your, and this is a compliment, by the way.
Thank you.
This is something that's been instilled in your mentality. And I think that positivity of not being completely run over life, by life, sorry, is something that I think is universally, like, admirable. Simply because you have an idea where, you know, even if you're feeling like you're plateauing or things are getting stale, you're resourceful enough to know that, okay, I've broken my wrist, I'm going to have to find a way to work around this, and sometimes I just have to sit down and recover.
I think Beyonce said it best, I'm a survivor. and that's what it is. It's about surviving, yeah. It's finding what will work. Knowing that I have to, I can't become stale, or I can't become stagnant, and I have to find the next thing, and I have to survive. Otherwise, people won't care.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I can't find a good example right off the top of my head, but or maybe Eugene's a great example.
Yeah.
If you remember 2006 or whatever, people loved Eugene. He was like, some people were like, this is the greatest wrestler ever. Now half the crowd, if not all of the wrestling fans, have completely forgotten who Eugene is.
Yeah.
You know, so like. And I have no fault of his, but it just, people forget and life goes on. Like, and so if you either stay in front of the crowd or you don't, and then you get forgotten.
Right. But I think there's enough buzz about this whole show and about, hell, there's, people are still going to go back and watch that, you know, that fourth wall breaking pipe bomb promo, and they're still going to hear your name, and that curiosity is always going to be there. And I think that you've left your imprint. And I think that you might not be on top of the world, but at least, you know, enough of the world is looking your way.
Yeah, I'm not complaining. But I know the reality is that I have to do something moving forward. Like, I can't just live on my Ring of Honor Tag Team Championship days. I can't just live on being in a developmental contract. Like, some people do. Some people get fired from developmental and they just try to get signed as, like, or they just try to get wrestling shows. They want to get booked on shows, being like, I was a former developmental. It's like, that means absolutely nothing, man.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the WWE, like, I used to be in WWE, and they're like, that means absolutely nothing. Like, what have you done in the last 10 years? Nothing. Nobody remembers you. You just have to stay relevant.
Absolutely. Last thing I'll bring up is, I normally ask people to pay it forward to somebody at the end of the show and say, check this person's music out, or their comedy out, or something like that. What I'm going to do with this one is a little different, because a lot of my fans are not necessarily wrestling fans.
Okay.
But I think there's enough universal concepts we've touched on here that anybody who's grinding it out there right now could learn from this conversation in some ways. So in a few years ago, I interviewed a man named Damien Abraham, otherwise known as Pink Eyes, from the band Fucked Up. And he led me to two wrestling matches. One was CM Punk versus Samoa Joe, and the other one was Necro Butcher versus Samoa Joe. And said, you know, watch these two matches, and it'll change your opinion on wrestling entirely. Sorry. So, is there like a match that you would say like a non-wrestling fan could watch, and just, or maybe a couple matches that you think a non-wrestling fan could watch and immediately become in some way emotionally invested, or in some way leave an impact on them?
Which is funny, because I always say my favorite match of all time was Samoa Joe versus Kobashi in New York City. So Samoa Joe's getting a lot of love here.
Yeah.
If I was to pay it forward to somebody, I would say watch Kenny Omega in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe even watch Kenny Omega versus a 9-year-old girl.
I just recommended that to my housemates, actually.
Yeah, and it's just like, you can sit here and you can laugh at the idea of Kenny Omega versus a 9-year-old girl, but you'll really see, A, how hard it is to make something look awesomely legit as an art form when it's a 30-year-old man in Japan. A 30-year-old white man in Japan from Canada who's actually from Winnipeg.
Yes.
And so I'm happy to give, you know, he's from this area and couldn't, you know, he had to go to Japan. He had to learn, like, there's so, I'm such a champion of Kenny Omega. I think so highly. He went to Japan. He learned Japanese. He speaks fluent. When I was over there, he was my translator. He speaks fluent Japanese. He's part of the culture. And he's really like, and he's a different wrestler, and he's something different. Sometimes you just get bored by hip tosses and body slams and arm drags. And Kenny really gets the idea of, like, you have to do something different and be different. And there's a clip on there of Kenny Omega versus a 9-year-old girl, and it's fucking brilliant. I really think it's brilliant. how he does it, and the reactions from everybody, and the girl herself too. There's just so much greatness to it. And I think you can appreciate it on so many different levels.
Oh, certainly. He actually, when I was reffing, he is actually in PCW, so he gave us all a pep talk backstage, and I just watched a few of his matches, and that one came up, and so I hate to admit it, I was trying not to laugh the whole time, because I'm just imagining him, you know, kicking that girl in the head.
But he also, I mean, him and Ibushi had this match, you know, in front of 10,000 paying customers to see him and Ibushi, the main event. Mm-hmm. And he's an unbelievable athlete, an unbelievable wrestler, so he can go to all spectrums.
Well, thank you so much for doing the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's great to finally meet you. I've been a fan for years.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on. It was a lot of fun.
It's nice to meet you.
Alright, so thank you so much for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen. That's it, that's our show for this week. I want to say a huge thank you to Colt Cabana for doing that interview. If you want to check out more Colt Cabana, find him at Colt Cabana on Twitter. You can also go to ColtCabana.com to look up bookings, dates, podcast episodes, ColtMerch.com if you're interested in getting one of those iHeart Colt t-shirts with the Star of David on it. I know mine has been getting me all kinds of comments downtown Winnipeg. As well as a Cult of Personality shirts, an Art of Wrestling shirt. There's tons of merch out there with this guy's face on it. As well as digitalcult.com if you want to download his $5 wrestling series or previous episodes of the podcast. Also, on top of that as well, you can check out Worst Promo Ever on YouTube. That's Colt Cabana and comedian Marty DeRosa. They do that series every week. You heard a clip of it earlier in the show. And remember, you can follow me at Mr. Matt Moskal on Twitter. That's at MRMATTMOSKAL to keep up with the show, to tweet at me. Let me know what you thought of this episode. I'd really like to, you know, hear some honest opinions. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, leave us some stars, leave us some reviews on our channels. Please do. I do this entirely pretty much out of my kitchen at this point in time. Or carry the apparatus around in a 20-pound bag to make sure that I can provide this content every week. So any positivity you want to send our way, we would more than gladly welcome it. Any negativity, you can go fuck yourself. But, you know, that's just my opinion, man. But thank you so much again to Colt for doing the show and for all of you for tuning in and listening. And we'll be back next week. I'm interviewing the members of the Noble Thieves, a local soul outfit who are performing at this year's Winnipeg International Jazz Festival. Let me know how you guys liked having a wrestler on the show, even. You know, if you're a regular fan of the show. And wrestling fans, you know, I hope I can tune you into some kind of music or comedian you've never heard of before. So let's do a little exchange here, shall we? Check out Kenny Omega versus a 9-year-old girl as well. And support your local wrestling, support your local comics, support local, pretty much. You know, everybody's got to live somewhere, and well, everybody's got to open for somebody sometime, too. So thank you so much for tuning in.